You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 26th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with ABC's London correspondent, Geoffrey Kaufman. What do you have for us today, Geoffrey?
Well, we are holding vigil for Nelson Mandela. We are watching more demonstrations in Brazil and watching the Supreme Court in the US for that long-awaited decision on gay marriage.
Plus, as Angela Merkel makes a $40 billion election promise, we'll ask the author of the new book, Angela Merkel, A Chancellorship Forged in Crisis, what her chances at the polls are.
Our woman in Pakistan will be here in London to tell us how tourism's taken a hit after the killing of 10 foreign climbers.
And in our preview of The Entrepreneurs, Katie Bilboa travels to Cannes to meet Benjamin Palmer, CEO of Barbarian Group.
When you're kind of out in front, like doing new things all the time, success is a different answer a lot. You kind of have to get good at figuring out new objectives along with the new ideas.
All that plus we'll review the morning's newspapers with Tom Edwards and check in with Monocle's editor in Bangkok. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
That is a very packed hour. Marcus Hippie, you're here as well. And I was just hearing that, Marcus, apparently you're from the particular region of Finland where all attractive people come from. Is that really true?
Dom, I was actually joking.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't want to reveal that was joking. I quite liked it when you bought that whole thing that I was talking about just before we launched the show.
Well, I was frantically Googling it. I mean, how do they do it? Is it something in the water?
I was talking about this because we just heard a song by Jenni Vartiainen before we started.
She's a handsome lady.
Yeah, I showed you photos. You liked what you saw, didn't you?
She's a pretty lady for sure.
Yeah, they all are good looking.
I could see that you might be from the same gene pool.
I think we should start this show,
Dom. Let's do it. Let's start with the news. David Spencer's here.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard has called a Labour Party leadership ballot in a bid to end uncertainty over her job. Supporters of former leader Kevin Rudd have begun fresh moves to try to oust Ms Gillard less than 3 months before an election. She said she'd retire from politics if she lost the vote and called on anyone contesting the leadership to do the same. US President Barack Obama and Afghan President Hamid Karzai have reaffirmed plans to hold talks with the Taliban despite an attack by militants on a secure Kabul compound. Tuesday morning's assault by Taliban militants cast doubt on attempts at peace talks, but the White House said that during a video conference, Obama and Karzai reconfirmed that an Afghan-led, an Afghan-owned peace process is the best way to ensure lasting stability in Afghanistan. Barack Obama's tried to revive his climate change agenda by promising new rules to cut carbon emissions from US power plants. With Congress unlikely to pass the legislation, the president said his administration would set rules using his executive authority. But Republicans have said they'll go to court to prevent Mr. Obama bypassing them. Mr. Obama says climate issues are a top priority of his second term.
For the sake of our children and the health and safety of all Americans, I'm directing the Environmental Protection Agency to put an end to the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from our power plants and complete new pollution standards for both new and existing power plants.
The United States is insisting Russia has a clear legal basis to expel the whistleblower Edward Snowden. He remains in the transit area of Moscow's airport, and Vladimir Putin says he won't sanction his extradition to the US. He's wanted there for revealing details of a US government surveillance program. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is appealing to Moscow to cooperate.
We're simply requesting, under a very normal procedure, for the transfer of somebody, just as we transferred to Russia 7 people in the last 2 years, that they requested that we did, without any clamor, without any rancor, without any argument.
Brazil's Congress has rejected a proposal that was a key grievance of protesters who've taken to the streets over the last few weeks. The measure, which demonstrators claimed could encourage corruption, was defeated by 430 votes to 9. Meanwhile, hundreds of demonstrators from two of Rio de Janeiro's most well-known slum neighborhoods have taken to the streets to demand better social services, including investment in education and healthcare. Alexa Dillan from the UK has lived in Rio for more than 2 years and took part in the latest demonstration.
Something that I've been dreaming of, that one day Brazilians are going to wake up and have a voice. And more people who live in a favela, they really, really need to have a voice, you know, because they've not been used to it. Police brutality is something that has saddened me ever since I've arrived here. There's a lot of injustice which go very much unnoticed by the press in Brazil.
Mongolians are voting in their presidential election, which pitches incumbent president Taxia Albegdorj up against a popular former wrestler and the country's first female candidate. Mining is a key issue in the vote, as it makes up 90% of the economy. Albegdorj, seen as more friendly to foreign investors, is expected to win re-election. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. It is 6 minutes past the hour. That is 16:06 in Tokyo, 8:06 in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
So let's kick off today's Midori House as we tend to with our agenda setter. This is the part of the show where we bring in our experts to choose three big stories that we need to know about in the 24 hours to come. And joining us in the studio today is Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Geoffrey, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Well, expert. I'm always intimidated by that word.
Yeah, you're an expert. You've got that's to live it. Up to you're an expert on three wildly
there
different
you go.
Issues, apparently.
Yeah. And when you cover the world, you become an internet expert on a lot of things.
Exactly. Indeed. We actually start in South Africa today. The first topic you would like to talk about is South Africa getting ready for the inevitable. Nelson Mandela is still in critical condition.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sad inevitability in life. He's 94. He's been declining for years. We know how this story ends, and the world watches, the world waits. It is emotional. I think that the longer it goes on, it will resonate, but I think we've had so much time now to prepare for his passing. But you know, he is... I've been down there a good number of times covering Mandela, and you know, I struggle to think, is there anyone else alive today who changed the direction of our world in that order of magnitude? And I really can't think of anyone. I mean, you could talk about someone like Fidel Castro, but I don't think I think that's a pretty conflicted legacy. Mm. In a positive, universally acclaimed manner, I think Mandela is the last of the greats.
Yeah, I'm certainly struggling to come up with any names. I wonder the way in which his passing will be covered is perhaps the news event for which organizations around the world will be best prepared.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess news organizations are better prepared for this than perhaps, you know, any other event in news history.
You know, we did this with John Paul II, Pope Watch, Mandela Watch. I mean, people outside journalism sometimes are a little horrified, but of course, you simply have to be ready. And when you know an event of this magnitude is coming and inevitable, you've got to be prepared.
I actually spoke about this very same topic with Alex Duval-Smith yesterday in one of our programs. She was emphasizing how extremely sensitive this whole topic is when it comes to the way media functions at the moment in South Africa. Do you think it's equally sensitive in other countries as well?
You mean in terms of simply waiting for Mandela,
exactly.
Mandela's demise? It's sensitive in South Africa because he is, he just so changed the shape of South Africa and Africa. You know, a country that in every way had reason to tear itself apart and erupt into bloody civil war. And he managed to avoid it, and he managed to allow forgiveness and conciliation to triumph. And for all the problems they have today, and all the tortured history, he managed to avoid a chapter that seemed almost inevitable, the kind of lashing out against the apartheid overseers and who so abused power and people for so long.
There does seem to be some confusion at this point. There's been each time he has gone into hospital in the past couple of years, the debate has raged over what his death will mean politically, if there will be a note of instability, if there will be problems. Essentially,
I don't think there will be. I mean, I think sadly South Africa's pretty unstable right now. Jacob Zuma is not a terrific president. There are lots of problems of corruption. We're seeing, you know, we had the horrific shooting at the Marikana mine. The strikers who are still the miners who are still grossly underpaid and not well treated. I mean, the improvements in life, as so often happens, and this actually segues us to our next topic. People want these new regimes, you know, the new orders to change and improve their lives, and they get impatient when things don't happen. It's just not that easy, and the democracy. As we know, is a cumbersome project, and it takes time, and it makes mistakes, and it's open to manipulation, which takes us to Brazil.
Exactly.
Today in Brazil, big football game, Uruguay versus Brazil in Belo Horizonte. I think it's the semifinals of the Confederation Cup. Why do we care about it? Because there's going to be yet another anti-government demonstration. There's a holiday today in Brazil. They expect at least 100,000 people on the streets, many of the Brazilian football players supporting these demonstrations. And it's really interesting, you know. We've talked about Turkey in the last couple of weeks and the public discontent there. Brazil and Turkey, two paragons of sort of the modern emerging world. You know, we've heard the term BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa appends its name to that, BRICS, the emerging economies of the future. Turkey certainly could be added to that list. And yet here you have Turkey and now Brazil facing serious, serious discontent with its leadership for different reasons, I should say. Turkey, because of Erdogan's efforts to impose Islamic order on what is a secular democracy. Brazil, the problem is simply that you have massive wealth and massive divide. The poverty there is still very extreme, and even those who are not in extreme poverty, those who in the working class, finding it very, very difficult to make ends meet and getting just absolutely frustrated watching all these gilded stadiums going up for the Confederation Cup, the World Cup, and then the Olympics, and saying, wait a minute, our education system is a mess. Our transport system is a mess. And it is one of the things, having worked and covered Latin America for 10 years, when I heard that Rio was getting the Olympics, I thought, wow, you can barely drive a car through Rio. The subway doesn't go very far. The airport's a shambles. The Olympics will improve it for Rio, but the rest of the country just has not had investment in infrastructure for public good. I mean, the ports are being upgraded now, the highways are for the mines, but you know, the government, Dilma Rousseff, has really got to respond, and I think her own re-election is very much at stake here.
Well, that's next year, isn't it? The election, which I'm sure she has in mind. And you drew the Turkey comparison. You know, I guess the sort of strongest parallel being countries experiencing new growth, and people are unhappy about exactly how that growth is being expressed, how that wealth is being spent in some way. I mean, Rousseff responded fast-ish,
reasonably. She's not a great communicator. Part of her problem, she doesn't have her predecessor Lula was you know, pretty charismatic. She falls pretty flat. I think most people would say her heart is in the right place, but you know, this is a huge, huge economy. 60% of the economy of South America is Brazil. I mean, people don't appreciate that. What you have, what, 15, 16 countries, but it really is all about Brazil.
Jeffrey, should we move on to your third topic? U.S. Supreme Court has been quite busy with gay rights issues.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court's been very busy. It's the end of term. I think today is, in fact, the last day of term. So this decision, which we've been waiting for several weeks, has to come down today. I thought it was tomorrow, possibly too, but it's my understanding, just in doing my morning reading, that it actually is today. Yesterday they came down.
10 a.m. in the U.S., I'm told.
Yeah, yesterday they came down with a very controversial decision on the Voting Rights Act in the U.S., which goes back to 1965, and the conservative majority, 5-4, overturned a key part of it, which is to protect, in 9 states, minority voters, in particular black voters, from being gamed out of the system. And it's a really, really huge blow for those who believe that that's still a problem. Now we're waiting for two decisions, two key decisions on gay marriage. One is the California referendum that overturned Proposition 8, which allowed Californians of the same-sex Californians to marry. And then the other is this very controversial Clinton-era legislation, the Defense of Marriage Act. I think the general consensus is that California's going to be get gay marriage back, that you can't take away a right that people have already had. The Defense of Marriage Act sense is that they may move on it, but they're not likely to impose gay marriage on the entire country. There are bigger federal issues in this because of taxation, immigration of partners. That's where the nuance in this is worth watching.
Okay, so it's connected with other departments. It's one of these sort of octopus issues with tentacles elsewhere.
Well, it's
elsewhere.
All fine to have, in California, New York, and about a dozen, 14 other states, including the District of Columbia, to have these rights. But you know, if your same-sex partner is from London or Rio, he or she cannot legally come into the country in the same manner as a heterosexual couple. And, you know, federal tax issues are a huge part of any relationship. So that's where this Defense of Marriage Act decision is critical. But the court is, it will be interesting to see, but it would be astonishing if they said same-sex marriage is legal in the entire country.
So 10 a.m.
We will be watching.
People will be watching. That was Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC.
Jeffrey, thanks. Now, coming up, we'll look at the career of Angela Merkel, arguably, of course, the most powerful woman in Europe, possibly the world. She's running for her third term as Chancellor and author of a new book will be with us shortly.
Monocle 24 continues its global summer tour with a stop-off in Thailand. This week, we'll be touching down in Bangkok for two very special editions of The Briefing. On Wednesday and Thursday this week, The Briefing will be coming live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre, presented by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and editor Andrew Tuck. We'll be bringing you a snappy roundup of the current state of affairs in Thailand's creative scene and meet the people making waves in Bangkok's thriving design community. So tune into The Briefing at midday UK time and 1800 in Thailand. On Wednesday and Thursday this week, live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre in Bangkok, right here on Monocle 24.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, Angela Merkel is probably the most powerful woman in Europe. No, certainly. In fact, she's probably the most powerful woman in the world. Perhaps inevitably, then, she's a controversial character who provokes the world's curiosity. So there's no lack of literature, then, describing her background and her career. Now, as Merkel runs for her third term as Chancellor, yet another biography tries to explain how she sees the world and what's behind her decision-making.
The new book, Angela Merkel, A Chancellorship Forged in Crisis, tries to put the leader of Germany in her political and cultural context. And at the same time, it claims that Merkel is often misunderstood, both in and outside of Germany. Joining us now is co-author of the book, Alan Crawford. Thank you for joining Midori House, Alan. First of all, Merkel is indeed a unique character in German post-war politics as both being the first female chancellor and the first from the former communist East as well. How unique have her policies been?
Well, she's not been necessarily unique, but she, in terms of policy, but in terms of herself and her character, that she is she's a very atypical politician. That she doesn't feel the need to speak in sound bites. She doesn't feel a need to drive the news agenda and appear on the front pages of the newspapers the next day. She's a very cerebral politician as opposed to a gut instinct politician. And in that sense, she shares a lot with Obama, President Obama, who was just here last week, of course, speaking right outside my office here on at the Brandenburg Gate.
Alan, we alluded to all of the various attentions that she receives. The fact that she is a woman is, of course, a factor in that. And, you know, in the discussions of Margaret Thatcher that stemmed a few months ago, there was plenty of discussion of how much a politician's womanness was central to how they were perceived. But we've said that she's misunderstood. How is she misunderstood? And is that a part of it?
Well, she's misunderstood because she doesn't communicate in the traditional means of giving grand speeches outlining her vision, if you like. What she does, she has a policy she calls of the Schritt for Schritt, step for step, step by step rather, where she cautiously goes about forging her her policy. And you really have to listen to what she says, and she telegraphs her meaning over a series of speeches rather than giving one big set piece delivering a single message.
I mean, does that not make it rather difficult for her, given that the sort of the methods of communication that she has, the outlet, so to speak, the media, has been shaped by a different type of politician? It's shaped for people who do deliver soundbites and who do announce themselves in one particular policy speech.
It doesn't make it difficult for her. It makes it difficult for us. And that's the reason that we wrote the book. This, just to correct you, actually, there are no books about Merkel in English because there are plenty of books in German, but because she doesn't give press conferences in English, she never gives interviews in English. She very rarely gives interviews to foreign media in general. In fact, last week was the first time she'd spoken to Bloomberg, and so she actually chooses the time and the place of communicating the message. And for foreign media in particular to try and get any insight, any entry to the closed halls of the Chancellery is extremely difficult.
Well, your co-author in this book, actually, he has had a chance of participating in those invitation-only gatherings where Merkel actually supposedly also displays some rare flashes of humour. What more can you tell about those meetings?
Well, we were told from people who meet with her regularly that, in fact, she has a great sense of humour, that she's an extremely good welcoming hostess, and she's usually the funniest person in the room. She has a particularly good chicken joke, I've been told. But she also, she tends to be the most intelligent person in the room. So, yeah, you have to be careful.
Well, that's handy then. So intelligence and a great chicken joke will get you far in German politics, clearly. But she's looking towards an election. We alluded in the introduction there to various sort of spending promises that have been announced to the tune of sort of 40 billion euros, I believe. How is she looking at this point in her kind of evolution as a sort of biographer? How significant a moment is this for her?
Well, it's hugely significant, potentially, because this election will decide whether she continues with her vision, if you like, of a more competitive Europe that is modelled along German lines. She never actually says that the rest of Europe has to be more like Germany, but she more or less means that they have to, you know, bring down the labour costs, they have to streamline their economies, conduct structural reforms to try and bring down unemployment and enable Europe to compete in the globalised age, where there's competition from all over the world, obviously. And she says that for Europeans to be able to maintain their standard of living in the future, they have to reform. And so this election will determine whether she can press ahead with this project and ultimately we'll see whether she's successful or not.
Alan, you've also been looking, obviously, to where Angela Merkel comes from. Her background is in the communist former east of Germany. And just a couple of months ago, there were claims in Germany that Merkel actually would be hiding something about her background. Supposedly, she had worked, at least to some extent, on agitation and propaganda for the communist youth organization there. What do you know about that? What is the latest regarding this?
Well, it's actually rather straightforward. Merkel says it's not true. And she very openly addresses these issues. And she says that there are all sorts of things about my past that the public doesn't know about. But in this instance, she says she has no recollection of that. And and it would appear to me to kill the story dead. Certainly, if she had, there's no suggestion that she had any connection with the Stasi. Revelations, allegations made in a German biography, and Merkel reacted to them in an extremely relaxed manner. And so, in all honesty, I don't know definitively, but I would find it very hard to believe that there are dark secrets buried in Merkel's past that have not been dredged up.
Certainly not been dredged up by you, at least for your biography. Well, Alan, thank you very much for joining us. Alan Crawford is co-author of the book Angela Merkel, A Chancellorship Forged in Crisis, which is, we are told, the only biography of her in the English language. This is Midori House. We are live in London, but the show following this one, The Briefing, will not be. It will be brought to you from Bangkok today and tomorrow too. Monocle's team there includes our editor-in-chief, our Hong Kong bureau chief, and of course our editor, Andrew Tuck.
And Andrew joins us now on the line to tell us what to look forward to on the show. Well, Andrew, thank you for joining this programme. You've got about 3.5 hours before you start the programme in Bangkok. What's coming up?
I thought you were going to take up 3.5 hours to explain what we were going to have on the show.
Yeah, we've got to fill a lot of time today, I'm afraid, so speak slowly.
That's the amount of time I need, I think. We have two very good shows lined up, and it's good to hear that someone's back in London. I thought everybody was in Bangkok. I think there's about 12 people from across the Monocle Empire here in Bangkok at the moment.
No, not all of us.
We've got two good shows coming up, and we're going to be coming from the TCDC, which is a big design centre. And we're going to be starting off each day with a newspaper editor coming in to look at the headlines here in Bangkok and in Thailand. We can always have a good business wrap-up. And today we sent Fiona Wilson and Aisha Spears, who are both here from our bureaus in Tokyo and Hong Kong, we sent them out on a mission to test the street food here in the city with an acclaimed writer on the subject.
Oh, that sounds exciting. Can you reveal at this stage what her findings were?
Well, I've just seen them down in the lobby, and they seem to be okay. Unlike me, who was taken to lunch by somebody who works for us here in Bangkok as well, she ordered a fish that was so hot, I had to kind of leave the table because my face was streaming with sweat from the chili. So I think they fared better than I did, actually.
That sounds amazing. Well, at the moment in London, it's about, I don't know, 19 degrees. It's quite cold over here. I expect it to be slightly warmer in Bangkok.
Well, it's the rainy season, and my gosh, as it rained. It's rained all day today on and off, but most days it kind of starts raining about 4 o'clock. I have not seen one patch of blue sky since I've been here, but you step outside and the humidity is extraordinary, so you have sweat pouring down your back and it's raining. It's a really kind of charming mixture.
Oh, lovely. Well, I'm sure you'll be bringing some Monocle sunshine to the area. We look forward to the briefing. That's in about 3.5 hours' time. Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editor, previewing the show there.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Buenos Aires.
To Hong Kong.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
To Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll head to Cannes to speak with Benjamin Palmer, CEO of Barbarian Group. We'll talk with our women in Pakistan and we'll review the morning's newspapers with our news editor, Tom Edwards. But first, here is David Spencer with the news headlines.
Marcus, thank you very much. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard has called a Labour Party leadership ballot in a bid to end uncertainty over her job. Supporters of former leader Kevin Rudd have begun fresh moves to try to oust Ms Gillard. The US and Afghan presidents have promised they are committed to peace talks with the Taliban, despite an attack in central Kabul on Tuesday. The assault by Taliban militants targeted the presidential palace and an office of the CIA. Russian President Vladimir Putin has confirmed that the US whistleblower Edward Snowden is still in the transit area at Moscow Airport. Mr. Putin says he remains a free man and should choose a destination sooner rather than later. The US insists Russia has a clear legal basis to expel Mr. Snowden. Bad weather is continuing to hamper rescue efforts in northern India, where the number of people killed in floods and landslides is feared to be more than 1,000. 680 people are confirmed dead after early monsoon rains in Uttarakhand state, but thousands of people are missing. A legal bid by Australia is getting underway to halt Japan's annual whale cull in the Southern Ocean. A hearing at the International Court of Justice in The Hague will hear claims that Japan's scientific whaling program is commercial whaling in disguise. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You are back with me, Dory House, on Monocle 24 with me, Marcus Hippi and Dominic Reynolds. Last week on the French Riviera, the world of advertising or creative communications gathered for the 60th anniversary Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity. It's the biggest event of its kind in the world, featuring seminars, talks, workshops, parties and award ceremonies for the much-coveted Grand Prix prizes, the advertising equivalent of winning an Oscar.
Well, alongside 12,000 delegates, Monocle's Katie Bilboa was there reporting for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, and one entrepreneur with whom she was keen to snatch 5 minutes was Benjamin Palmer, CEO of Barbarian Group. Based in New York, Ben and his team specialise in interactive and digital work for global brands including GE, Pepsi and Bloomberg.
Their pioneering software, Cinder, has been helping other agencies produce award-winning campaigns for several years, and now their hard work has been rewarded with a Grand Prix in the brand new Innovation Lions category. In the bustling lobby of the Carlton Hotel, Benjamin explained how he grew Barbarian Group from just himself to become one of the leading agencies in their field.
We're about a little over 100 people now, and we started off primarily doing production work. We would be hired by a larger advertising agency. They didn't know how to make anything on the web. It took them a while to build that capacity. So they would hire us on a more temporary basis to do the creative work and build it. So that was actually the best way we found to be in the flow of progress in the digital world. you know, and make like a decent living and do stuff that we thought was really interesting. Our first like big famous thing was called the Subservient Chicken, and it was in 2006, and it was the first big brand hit on the web, and we had like 100 million hits, and it was completely off the charts, you know. And that got us enough attention that brands started talking to us directly, you know, and so we started getting our own relationships with brands.
Thank you.
And in the last, I would say the last 3 years, we've gone through a bigger sort of evolution. At that point, you're now like shepherding brands or companies, you know, on top of just doing communications around specific products or objectives, you're actually thinking in the long term about how brands interact with their audiences and like on an ongoing basis. And we're doing that from a sort of a digital centerpiece.
How do you measure success? Do you see it as the number of times someone's clicked on something or someone's viewed something or shared something? Or is it more about how much money that then equates to for your clients? Can you monetize it? And is that the way that you measure what's doing well and what's not?
That's a good question. When you're kind of out in front, like doing new things all the time, success is a different answer a lot. It varies from situation to situation, and you kind of have to get good at figuring out new objectives along with the new ideas, you know. So it can be the number of hits. Sometimes if you're introducing a new product, like say Pepsi, we help them with new product launches. Some of that's awareness, but some of that's trial, like just getting people to try it. If we can drive a certain number of people to redeem a coupon at a store or something more digital than that, that can be an objective. The most interesting one is probably sentiment. So you end up in interesting sort of nooks and crannies with that. And so just kind of trying to change people's perception in a more fundamental sort of way can be an objective too.
So let's talk a bit about the Innovation Lion that you won. Explain the product that won the prize.
So we won the Grand Prix for the brand new Innovation Lions category at Cannes. And that was for a product that we've been making for several years now called Cinder. We're doing some projects where there's a lot of really heavy lifting visual processing, and there's basically no Photoshop for that. We kind of were using two different types of tools at the same time and mashing them together, and it was very time consuming, so we started making our own tools. And then we got that to a certain point where we realized that the best thing we could do is to open source it, which is pretty unusual in the advertising industry. Most people, if they made a creative software tool, would figure out how to charge, you know, $10,000 licenses to all the other advertising agencies. We actually took the approach that if we put it out there, more people will contribute to the product and make it better. But even more importantly, there's probably 50 projects that have won a prize here in the last like 3 years that have used Cinder in some way, but there's actually probably only 50 people in the world that are really good at using Cinder right now, and there should be more. And so winning the prize is actually really great for Cinder itself.
So what's the benefit of you creating this product and then giving it away for free? Why did you decide to do that?
Because we think that people should be making better work if they can, and this makes things cheaper, faster, better in a lot of areas of creative coding. Part of it is that we're actually a few years in now, we're starting to hire some of the best people out there that have been using Cinder for a couple of years. And a couple of years ago,
it comes back to you eventually.
It does come back to us eventually, yeah. And because Cinder's our in-house tool, you know, we maybe have an advantage over some other companies in hiring top technical talent. So we have a deeper bench than other agencies would have in areas like this.
And just finally, isn't it 60th year, Cannes Lion? We're all here. There's lots of people here, as we can hear in the background. But do you think the event is still relevant? Do you come here because you feel like you have to come, or do you come here because it's genuinely beneficial?
Yeah, I think everybody gets something out of it when they come here, even if it's just a hangover, you know, but I find it to be really useful. Something good always comes of it. And if you win a Lion, it's like extra fun, I guess, you know.
That was Benjamin Parker, CEO of Barbarian Group, speaking amidst a sort of crowded room, by the sounds of things, to Katie Bilboa for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, which you can catch tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after a short break with our woman in Pakistan. She is here in our London studio. Stay tuned.
With a nod to the past and a wink to the future, Monocle takes a look at the world of perfume and the new generation of expert alchemists.
One of the things that becomes quite an achievement in fragrance is creating that intangible magic when three or four or five disparate elements come together. And in that sense, it's not dissimilar to the visual arts, to painting, or to music.
Artisan Perfume Makers, a film from London, New York, and Buenos Aires on Monocle.com.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the global pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time is 16:41 in Tokyo, 8:41 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, which usually means we talk to someone a few thousand miles away. But luckily for us, Monocle's Pakistan contributor Samira Shackle is here in London today and joins us now in the studio. Samira, welcome to Midori House.
Hi.
The first topic from you is quite a heavy one. 10 foreign climbers have got killed by militants in Pakistan, and the impact on tourism in the area seems to be quite significant.
Yes, absolutely. So this happened in Gilgit-Baltistan, which is a province in the north of Pakistan, which is actually one of the safest provinces in general. It's one of the very, very few places in the country where tourism for leisure actually still happens. I mean, you don't really hear about that anywhere else in Pakistan, and it's primarily from Russia, elsewhere in Eastern Europe, from China. It's not so much from sort of America or the UK. But, you know, they're even from the US or UK, I think the occasional committed climber does go up there. Mm. So I think it's really having a devastating effect on the area. And this is not just foreign tourists, it's Pakistani tourists go there, expats living in Islamabad. It's one of the very few areas where foreigners previously felt quite safe to go with no security. And I think it's, you know, there's not much other industry there. I think it's going to have quite a devastating effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much everything to that economy, isn't it? And I wonder what we know about, you know, the whys of this situation. I mean, is there any particular reason they were targeted, or is it simply their foreignness and the fact that they were there at all?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. And I think certainly recently with terrorist attacks in general, we've seen that that people are so inured to the daily news of a small-scale bomb blast somewhere in Pakistan, it doesn't make international headlines. It barely, to be honest, makes domestic headlines anymore, unless there's a very big death count. So I think there's this increasing emphasis on finding soft targets, shocking targets, things which are going to make an impact and sort of ultimately spread terror, which is the aim. So I think it's not completely out of the blue. We had some sectarian killings in the area of Shia Muslims last year. But generally, it's a fairly sort of peaceable area. I think people are quite shell-shocked.
Do you think there's anything Pakistan can do to try to increase the security in that area where these attacks happened, to convince foreigners that you can still come here?
Yeah, I think as with the rest of Pakistan, there's a sort of policing is horribly under-resourced. So after these sectarian killings, there's a few more checkposts, there's a few sort of army points around there. Seems that hasn't really stopped it. And I think I imagine what we'll see instead, as we've seen elsewhere in the country, is a big rise in private security. You'll see groups of foreign climbers going up there but taking their own armed guards with them, or climbing companies guaranteeing a sort of van full of policemen, which, I mean, having travelled around the country with this level of security, I mean, I think some of the times I felt least safe in Pakistan are in within an armoured vehicle in a convoy of sort of police trucks. So, I mean, it sort of hinders the travelling experience somewhat.
Okay, let's move on to the politics, of which there is plenty to talk about at the moment. So Pervez Musharraf is going to be tried for high treason. We weren't sure what was going to happen to him for a while, but this is what's happening now. The sort of axis that I guess we tend to focus on around this issue is Nawaz Sharif's control over the army, or vice versa, and how does this situation kind of feed into that argument?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people have been predicting that, had been predicting that Musharraf, they say there's no way the army's going to allow him to be tried. He's going to be given a safe exit. And I think actually, in a way, it would have been a lot easier for Nawaz Sharif if the caretaker setup had, while Musharraf was arrested on bail, having come back to the country to fight the election, if he'd just been sort of let out before the new government came in. As it is, that's going to really look like a sort of sign of weakness, I think, for the government. And we must also not forget that it was Musharraf who ousted Nawaz Sharif from power in a military coup in 1999. And so while I think Sharif's been quite sensible, he doesn't want a repeat of what happened last time when he sort of tried to put the army in its place and got kicked out of power, essentially. He's been quite sensible. He's let the Supreme Court raise the charges. He hasn't acted on his own. But I think there's certainly an element of tit for tat. He sort of brought up the 1999 coup when he was talking about the treason charges, even though the Supreme Court's previously found that that was actually legal, and it's the 2007 state of emergency they're trying him for. So I think there's some quite interesting power politics at play there.
So yeah. If Musharraf is indeed to be tried, what happens next?
Well, it's quite difficult to underplay how significant it would be for a chief of the army to be tried for something that they did while they were chief of the army in Pakistan. You know, it's an incredibly, incredibly powerful institution, and that would have huge ramifications for the balance of power, sort of for the unwritten aspect of the constitution. I think it would be absolutely seismic, which is why it's quite difficult to imagine the trial going ahead, really. I think also what Musharraf's lawyers are saying is that it wasn't just him. There's up to about 700 bureaucrats below him who sort of helped him do all of this for acts which are now being considered illegal. So where do you stop? And I think what some people are fearing is that Nawaz Sharif, who's been reasonably measured about it so far, will sort of stop being, and the ultimate charge for, one of the sentences for high treason can be death. So I think people are a bit worried about, you know, it's not out of the question in Pakistan, let's say.
Indeed. Well, let's briefly talk, if we can, about other things that Nawaz Sharif is undertaking in his still relatively new role. Last time I spoke to you, you were complaining of incredible heat and a lack of aircon, a difficult combination with which a lot of Pakistan is suffering at the moment. Is he making any progress on the energy issue?
Well, we hope so, I think. yes, that's one of the reasons I'm sitting in London enjoying the cold. it's a very difficult issue, the energy crisis. He's staked a lot on it. There's this huge problem of circular debt. Sort of the consumers owe the energy companies money, the energy companies owe the government money, and sort of it's a big mess. He's taking some steps to sort it out. It's not exactly clear yet where the money's going to come from. Nawaz obviously has very good relationships with Saudi Arabia, where he spent his time in exile. And so it seems like there might be a big injection of Saudi cash, which people have mixed feelings about in Pakistan, I think. But if it keeps the lights on and the aircon on, I think that's going to have huge positive effects on the economy and just quality of life.
Samira Shackle, Monocle's contributor in Pakistan, thank you very much for this.
Right, up next we'll review the morning's papers with our news editor Tom Edwards. He'll be here shortly, but to get us to Tom, for reasons that apparently will soon become clear, here is Money Don't Matter Tonight by Prince. Money didn't matter yesterday. That was Prince with Money Don't Matter Tonight.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Marcos Hippie and Dominic Reynolds. And joining us now in the studio to go through the morning's newspapers is Monocle's Tom Edwards. Hello, Tom, and thank you for joining us here. Would you, first of all, would you like to explain the reason for that song, besides that you like it, obviously?
It works, Marcos, on several levels.
I think you're both going to enjoy this.
Okay, it works on several. It may not work on a purely musical level.
Let's go. So, Prince, Money Don't Matter Tonight. What's the connection?
What was the name of the artist? Let's start with the basics.
Okay, Brian Prince.
So, I've got a story for you about a prince.
Good.
That's right, Don Marcos.
Surely these things don't happen by accident. Surely that's the only link you could have squeezed into one song.
A lot of thought going into these kind of things. Okay. It's the Sheikh from Sandhurst, says the Independent, who has the keys to the capital. This is a story we talked about on Monocle 24 yesterday. Qatari Crown Prince Sheikh Tamim, who's been handed the reins of power by his father, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani. And he's one of a number of these leaders from all around the world, but particularly in the Middle East, who are kind of schooled in the old institutions of Britain, be it Harrow, the celebrated public school, or Sandhurst, as named the sort of famous military academy. And apparently it's going to be a fairly safe transition of power, people hope, in terms of stability for the not inconsiderable Qatari holding assets, many of which are based in this country. Not just in terms of shares, they own huge chunks of things like Sainsbury's, Barclays Bank, of course.
Harrods as well.
But also exactly famous land stock. Harrods, they bought that for about $1.5 billion. That was on your shopping list, wasn't it, Dom, for a time?
Yeah, unfortunately I only had $1.25 billion that week. Sorry.
Wasn't going to work out. And other things as well. The Shard, of course, a big player in that. And plenty of other important real estate.
That's really interesting how these kind of things become, you know, reflected on the British news agenda just because there is so much money over here. You know, this transfer of power is definitely bigger news in this country than, say, in my home country, Finland.
Is that because there's just less stuff that people want to buy there, Marcos?
Ooh, and there's definitely less Qatari money.
They're not snapping up saunas left, right and centre?
By the way, let's continue with your other stories. I'm still quite puzzled by this song.
So what was the song?
Prince.
So it was by Prince, so that was a Prince. That's pretty good.
So
what was the song title?
Once again, Money Don't Matter Tonight.
Now, I think a man who would say money does matter.
Oh, good.
Go with me on this.
Okay.
It's Mervyn King.
Brilliant.
Erstwhile Governor of the Bank of England, who's saying farewell. And he has made his last appearance before the panel of MPs. They didn't always get on that well with Mervyn.
No.
And this is in The Guardian. It's goodbye to King. It's like goodbye to the King, you know.
Yeah, I see.
But not to the slump, says Philip Inman and Katie Allen. And they have actually a nice sketch by Caroline Davis in The Guardian today. The last time for the downbeat governor. Some of the MPs were a bit mean to Mervyn.
Well, they were, and he did get a rep for not being particularly kind of ebullient, though, to be honest, that's not a quality that you'd look from a Bank of England governor.
It's not what I'd want, but I thought they were a bit mean. John Mann, if you remember, he's quite a kind of hard-hitting MP. He'd prepared his final salvo, says Caroline Davis, saying to Mervyn, at his farewell appearance, by the way.
Oh, a bit harsh.
Isn't the real problem? We've listened too much to central bankers, not naming him by name, but probably pointing his finger,
and holding up a picture.
Who got it wrong in giving advice during the last 10 years. And King replied apparently with a tight smile saying, well, you won't be surprised if I disagree with you. And Andrew Tyrie, that noted wit, chimed in, not for the first time.
Oh, boom. Wow. It's like the script of Friends,
exactly,
but with more financial data.
But there's several things that are quite interesting. I mean, one is obviously we've got Mark Carney, very high profile Canadian central banker who's coming in to take over. Is he going to take up the mantle where King left off? Is he going to bring his own take to things? Obviously, he's got a lot of credit for handling the sort of austerity program very well back at home.
Mm.
So that's one thing that's interesting we'll observe. And another thing, woman of note, they mentioned. We've touched on this yesterday. The money. Is there going to be a lady on the British money?
Oh, that's interesting.
Interesting times.
So who are the contenders?
Basically suggests that probably there is.
Well, I think it would make sense.
Do you know who it's probably going to be?
Go on.
Jane Austen.
Oh, that's a good one.
I know, Marcos, you've read all of Jane Austen's works.
I'm a massive fan.
Are you pleased with that news?
I am.
But you know what?
You know what, Tom Edwards? I bet your third story can't have much more to do with Prince and the notorious song Money Don't Matter Tonight.
Well, do you know what? It does. And shall I explain why?
Please.
Has he done this? He's like the Houdini of
what's often described
reviewing
as, Marcos Hippie, the prince among birds. Come on, you know this. You're both keen on mythology. Of course, it's the hawk. Let's head to Wimbledon. The lawn tennis championships are taking place. Let's go to the Daily Telegraph. They like to document the alternative side to the event. A poor return. Do you get that? That's like a tennis pun in the headline.
Thanks for walking me through this.
A poor return by the center court hawk. Now, our American listeners will say, hawk? Hawkers? Is someone hawking tickets? No, this is a real hawk. The bird American of prey. Friends. Do you know what his name is? His name is Rufus. Yes.
Where does he come from?
He lives in home counties, Marcus.
Yeah. As do most Wimbledon spectators.
That's right. But apparently, he's been getting a taste of his own medicine. Now, Rufus is brought in each year to scare away pigeons. You can imagine the mess they wreak on the around the place. So Rufus scares the pigeons away. He does a few circuits.
He's a scare pigeon.
That's right. But last year, he was stolen from a car. I think he was being kept in some sort of small bag somewhere. Yeah. He was stolen in a car. He was eventually handed in. He's now apparently developed a fear of people in hoodies.
In hooded tops, because that was the dress.
Well, we can only assume
his thief had.
That was the thief.
The poor bird is traumatised.
So he's traumatised by that, but now apparently he's scared of crows.
Is that a new thing?
I'm sorry, but I think he's pretty much not qualified for the job now.
Well, no, but crows aren't necessarily a problem. His handler, Imogen Davis, who's shown here, says the crows come in big groups and dive bomb Rufus.
Oh, this is ridiculous. He's not a scare hawk now. He's a scaredy hawk.
I think
she insists he's not scared of pigeons, though, and that's what he's there.
I think we should let him start his pension, finally. That was Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, with the morning's newspapers. And that's all we have time for today, thanks to our producer, Daniel Ciacopelli, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anton Fredriksson, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is The Menu, Monocle's food and drink programme, hosted by yours truly.
And tomorrow's Midori House will be hosted by Phil Hahn as well. So that's all for today. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.